Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Universal, Brexit and the Beatles. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Andy.
How are you?
I'm trying to have new ways of greeting you. Because usually I go, hello! I'm bored of that. So last week I tried good morning.
Mm-hmm. That didn't work.
This week I'm going with hello, Andy. Spence is already building now as to what I might go with next week. I mean, that's worth...
I mean, I think you might go completely off the wall next week.
Just signing
just
up.
Start screaming.
If you've just randomly tuned into this on your audio booms or your SoundClouds or your Spotifys... Turns out people do listen to this podcast on Spotify.
Yeah.
Andy used to claim that no one did. And it turned out he wasn't looking at the right box.
No.
The analytics.
Audio Boom only recently added the Spotify stats.
Is that what it is?
They kept it quiet that they weren't.
Wasn't your ignorance.
This is stuff that people don't need to know.
Last week at the start of the old podcast, we talked about the heat wave at quite some length.
Yeah.
I thought it was quite interesting that as the podcast went live, goes live on a Monday morning.
It does.
Quite early on a Monday morning.
I know.
As it went live,
tell me.
We were just putting together the top story for Monday's CMU Daily about how Bestival had been cancelled because of all the wind and the rain. The last day of Camp Bestival, to be precise, because actually Bestival's still to come. Although by the time this podcast has gone out, it may have happened. Anyway, it was the last day of Camp Bestival that was cancelled because of all the wind and the rain.
Yeah.
And various other events around the country, not quite so high profile, were cancelled. So as the podcast went out, the heat wave was over. But now it's back.
Yeah.
Who knows by the time this podcast goes out. It's amazing, isn't it, how the weather changes.
It is amazing. Worth talking about for 3 weeks straight.
Well, I got so many emails on Monday saying, isn't it nice now the hot weather's gone? So,
Well, if they'd have listened to the podcast, they would have had your prediction that it was coming back.
So,
your dad's prediction.
Oh, that now you're going back.
Did we not do that last time as well?
No.
Yeah.
You're getting very confused now about our various discussions about the weather on Setlist. Anyone would think it's becoming a bit of a theme. You see, what happens is, I mean, you probably just think that we rock up and we just waffle inanely for an hour. And I appreciate that that's what it sounds like.
But we put a lot of work into making it sound like that.
Yeah, that kind of inane, irrelevant waffle
doesn't just happen. We've all this for a full week. We start rehearsing as soon as we finish. I rehearsed stumbling over that bit.
Did you?
Yeah. For hours.
We don't.
Just that.
We don't rehearse. But Andy does do some notes. So we do have some notes. And the notes always say, this week, Universal Brexit, but that's always at the top of the notes.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you have, welcome to Setlist, because he still can't remember his intro, even though he's done it exactly the same for months.
That's true.
My bit, where I'm now sort of varying it, isn't in the notes. That's probably why there's been a lack of variety. But then usually we have a couple of bullets about the sort of waffle we might want to do at the start of the podcast before we get into the coming up this week. But nothing there this week. Just dot, dot, dot.
It's enough, isn't it?
What does an ellipsis sound like when we're at the start of a podcast? So other than the things we're going to talk about, nothing of interest has happened this week for us to waffle. Hence us reverting to the weather, because we're British. If you're not listening in the UK, you have to understand that in this country, whenever there is nothing specifically in the notes, when Andy doesn't tell people what to talk about, we generally revert to the weather. Occasionally these days, we revert to the old Brexit thing. But we can't do that because we've got a whole section of this week's set list on the whole Brexit shambles.
Yeah.
So we can't have that up here, up front. So maybe you should just get straight on with this. Is that basically the gist of what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Well, get on with it then.
I'll do that, yeah. Coming up this week, we got fears for UK artists touring in Europe after Brexit.
That's better. That's good. Yeah, just said that, actually.
And researchers claims that Paul McCartney is wrong about which Beatles songs he wrote.
Yeah, he did all of that much better in the rehearsal.
But first, Universal Music's parent company, Vivendi, has confirmed that it's planning to sell a portion of that music company, but not, as it had previously indicated, via an IPO, which is a shame because we had a bit of a running theme of IPO chat recently.
We did.
And Vivendi have spoiled that.
There will not be a Universal Music IPO to add to the Tencent Music IPO, the Sonos IPO, and the Eventbrite IPO.
No, but they are going to sell off half of Universal Music.
Up to half.
They haven't decided.
So there has been speculation for quite some time now that Vivendi, this French conglomerate...
Water company.
...that was once a water company set up by Napoleon. Not the Napoleon, I don't think.
A Napoleon.
A Napoleon. I mean, like Napoleon III. I mean, an important Napoleon, although not the Napoleon you're thinking of. Anyway...
One with two hands to hold lots of water.
It started off as a water company. It hasn't been a water company for a very long time. And in more recent years...
I mean, Napoleon Bonaparte, he sailed ships. I mean, that's a water company sort of, isn't it?
Yeah, but...
He worked with water.
He didn't establish a company called Vivendi in order to provide water in which his ships could sail.
Could have done if he wanted to.
Whereas Napoleon III said he didn't need it for his ships.
The indie musician, you mean?
I think I assume he was... I don't know whether it was a water company or whether it was a bottled water company. I assume back then it kind of meant bottled water. Anyway, this is what we talk about.
No, but I think it's important that we work this out.
Vivendi was once a water company. It hasn't been a water company for a very long time.
No, it owns other things now.
In more recent years, it has been an entertainment conglomerate because it bought a load of entertainment companies in the late 1990s. That all went horribly, horribly wrong. There was a period where it all crashed and went to pot. But when it came out of that, although it sold off some of the Universal companies, like the Universal Studios and Universal Television, they're not part of Vivendi, but it kept Universal Music. And so in more recent years, the big Vivendi businesses have been Universal Music, which it owns outright, Canal Plus, and Studio Canal, which is the French TV company with a little bit of movie studio on the side.
I mean, Studio Canal is quite a big movie studio.
They did make Paddington, didn't they? Which is quite a big movie.
I mean, they make a lot of big movies.
All right, then. That big...
You're saying it's got a bit of movies on the side.
That big... It's really
Napoleon would be appalled.
It's really a movie studio with a little TV channel on the side.
Well, it is one of France's biggest TV channels.
Is it?
I mean, it's...
One of the main ones. I wouldn't say it's one of the biggest ones.
I think it's one of the biggest ones.
Although my knowledge of... French TV is kind of up there with my knowledge of 19th century water enterprises. So you have Universal Music, you've got Canal Plus, and then you've got some other stuff. It has some interesting gaming, not as much as it used to, but interesting gaming. It used to have interesting various mobile networks. I think it's sold all of those now. It has a bit of ticketing. It owns C Tickets here in the UK and a bunch of other ticketing stuff. A bit of live music stuff, which is confusing because sometimes it does live music stuff as Universal and sometimes it does it not as Universal.
Yeah.
They now have Havas, which is a big marketing and PR group that used to be in sort of common ownership with Vivendi in that they had a key shareholder in common. But as of last year, they're now part of one business. But that is what Vivendi does. And there has been speculation for some time that Universal Music is one of its wholly owned subsidiaries. It might seek to sell off. Well, some of the reports have been it's going to sell Universal. But that has never been officially on the cards. No. They've never said they're going to sell it. What they have said is they may sell a slice of it in order to get some money. And yeah, for a while, we did think that they might do that by floating it on a stock exchange, keeping a chunk of the equity themselves, allowing a certain portion to be bought and sold on whatever stock exchange they floated it on. And that wasn't just rumour and idle speculation that there might be an IPO.
No, although initially it was quite speculative in that it was based largely on Vivendi bosses started talking about Universal Music's valuation in relation to the streaming boom and how Universal was now making lots of money off streaming. And people started saying, well, why are they talking about valuations and big valuations? I think they started off with 20 billion. They went up to like 40 billion.
I think that
based
was...
They were not firm valuations.
No, that was them saying, oh, people have been valuing Universal.
Yeah,
but I mean, in official like events and conferences and stuff, and that was right, yeah, ooh, one person valued it at 40 billion.
Yeah.
And it was sort of a, isn't that insane? Oh, but really, that's what we believe. I mean, it isn't worth anything like that. But yes, so about a year ago, they started on several occasions to say, let's talk about the valuation of Universal. And that, there had been speculation before that they were going to sell it or sell a slice of it, but that really heightened this idea that there might be an IPO coming.
Yeah, and when they denied it, they'd always denied it before, whenever there was speculation. No, of course not. No. And then they started going, well, this company's worth a lot of money, isn't it? It's a company that we own. And so people took that to mean we're going to sell it or we're going to float a part of it. And then more recently, they actually outright said they were looking into the possibility of an IPO, what might be involved, how it might work. They didn't come out and say, we're going to do an IPO, but they did say, we're looking into it. We're going to see. We'll see if that's an option. They announced this week that there's not an option. It would be too complicated to float a bit of it on the stock market. So instead, they're just going to sell off up to half of it.
To, and I open a quote here, strategic partners. And then I close the quote there.
So people they would continue to work with.
Yeah, people they A, like, and B, because it would be a private transaction rather than just selling it off on a stock exchange, they would get to decide who should also have a slice of Universal Music. And you alluded before to the fact that this is all in the context of the streaming boom, which, of course, we've talked about before on Setlist, has sent the record industry, the recorded music market, that for 10 years between 2000 and 2010 was just in steep decline, and then was pretty much flat for about 5 years till 2015. But in the last few years has started to go back into growth, and that growth is almost exclusively fueled by the boom in the streaming market and mainly the premium subscription services, so Spotify, Apple, Amazon, and the others. And that is helping record companies go back into growth so that every quarter, every month, every year, the Universal Musics of this world are seeing the revenues coming in from their vast catalogues of sound recordings going up. On the back of that, there is now renewed interest in investment circles in owning music rights, whether those are recording rights or song copyrights. Obviously, investors got quite nervous about particularly recording rights when the record industry was in freefall. Now there is renewed interest. So yeah, you're sort of sensing that Vivendi are saying, right, now's the time to cash in on this.
Yeah, well, either, depending on how you look at it, they're either saying there's so much interest in this now because streaming is kind of the big thing that everyone's talking about at the moment. So now's the time to really capitalize on this. Or they're saying, well, this is great. There's lots of interest, but this is a bubble that is going to burst. We better get in on it now.
Because as we've discussed at length on Setlist, although it's exciting that streaming is booming and it's exciting that that's taken the record industry back into growth, that boom in streaming is all reliant on what are currently loss-making businesses. So the streaming services themselves, the Apple Musics, the Spotifys, etc., they're not making any money. A lot of revenue, but no profits. That's clearly untenable long-term. At some point, those companies have got to go into profit. And so, yes, there are some people saying that everyone's very excited at the moment, but could it all go horribly wrong down the line? Also, in addition to whether or not the streaming market is going to be successful in the long term, there is also the issue that the way artists work with record companies is starting to change with the rise of the distributors and label services companies, with obviously talk of Spotify possibly licensing in content directly from artists' own labels rather than relying on middleman distributors to get access to that content. But even if we're not going to sort of write off record companies and say, oh, the streaming services are going to cut out the labels at some point in the future, because I don't think they are. But it is true that when artists are signing to record companies, generally artists are getting better deals now than they used to. I mean, most artists and managers of artists, particularly new artists, signing to Universal labels, they're not happy with those deals. But I mean, they are better than the deals that they were getting 20 years ago and way better than 40 years ago. And another thing that's starting to happen is artists are really putting pressure on record companies, and on the publishing side, it's become the norm that whereas in the olden days, when a Universal Music, whether it was the label or the publisher, signed a new artist, they would be looking for ownership of the copyrights that those artists were creating, so recordings and songs, and they would be looking for ownership of those rights for what we call life of copyright. So once the deal was done for the recordings and the songs covered by that deal, the label, the publisher, would control those rights until the copyright ceased to exist. So, I mean, that's 70 years on the recording, life of the writer, and another 70 years on the songwriting side. And we're starting to see a pushback from that. So now on the publishing side, certainly in the UK, as a writer, as a manager of a writer, you would never do a life of copyright deal. And the likes of Cobalt have been pushing the term down ever more because Cobalt were offering really favourable deals of just a few years. And that's almost starting to become the norm. On the recording side, the major labels with new talent deals still are pushing for life of copyright, but you are starting to see a bit of pushback from artists and managers because of the rise of the label services and the distributors. So even if streaming does survive in the long term, and it's not just a temporary bubble that goes horribly wrong, and even if the streaming services don't cut the labels out, for a lot of the new music and the new artists that are coming along, the labels are not going to control that music for as long as they used to. So it may well be that all of these things will conspire to mean that even if the record industry at large continues to be in growth for the foreseeable future, even if the labels retain their crucial position in helping artists put out and distribute music, it may not be as lucrative for the labels long term as it looks like it is at the moment.
Yeah, so hopefully these strategic partners remain excited for at least the time being.
Yeah, and Vivendi said that they were going to start these conversations with these mysterious strategic partners in the autumn, hoping to have any transactions that come out of that done within 18 months. So I suppose they just need to maintain the hype and the glory and the glee for 18 months until they get those other strategic partners on board, cash the checks. And then it doesn't matter. Well, it will matter because they'll still own at least 50%
of
the
company. Well, yeah, if they get the investment and then the company completely crashes, I mean, that's not the ideal outcome, is it?
Although Vivendi presumably, I mean, I don't know, they might pass that money back to their shareholders. I imagine they would use that cash pile to diversify and to move into other areas. It's certainly what they've done before. Vivendi, when they've sold off, like they used to have much more interest in gaming and mobile, as I said. And when they sold that off, they then used that money to invest elsewhere. So it might be sort of spreading the risk. Okay, we have slightly less of a control over Universal, but we use that money to move into something else. And that means that if down the line music starts to wobble again, we'll be fine because we'll also then have a stake in another part of the entertainment industry or something like that.
Water.
Water. Go back into...
entertaining water.
into the... where they started, back into the water business. The other interesting side of this is all conglomerates that have lots of different businesses, but which are doing something similar. So like Vivendi, where you have your music company and you have your gaming company and you have your ticketing company and you now have your marketing company. So there is some crossover in what all those divisions are doing, even though they're autonomous businesses. The people at the top of those big parent groups always want the various different strands of the business to collaborate more and to have more sort of synergies between them. And you really sense that when they brought Havas in, because, as I say, it did used to have a key shareholder in common with Vivendi, and there were plenty of collaborations going on, particularly between Universal Music and various Havas agencies. And when they actually made Havas part of Vivendi, you felt that that was furthering this whole idea of where's the opportunity in music in the future? I know, working with brands, now we've got actually within the company a big brands division over here, a big music division over here. Maybe we can merge these two together, get more synergies going on. But obviously, once you start bringing other shareholders into some of those businesses, sometimes that can slightly scupper the attempts to have more synergies going on. That said, the main reason we've been talking about Vivendi, as opposed to Universal, on recent editions of the Setlist podcast, is because of the Spinal Tap lawsuit,
yes,
which is all about there being too much synergy between Universal Music, which controls the Spinal Tap soundtrack, and the aforementioned Studio Canal, which now controls the rights in the This Is Spinal Tap movie, and various allegations about what's been going behind the scenes with the way royalties are processed and money is moved between the label and the movie studio, etc. All of which we should stress Vivendi deny. But that was a lawsuit based around the idea that it wasn't a good thing to have the music and the movies all in one business working more closely together.
Yeah, so maybe we'll return to this in the autumn when we have a bit of a clearer idea of who these strategic partners are, assuming that we will by then. Still to come, mathematicians challenge Paul McCartney's songwriting claims, plus some news in brief. But now, with the deadline for the UK government to secure a deal on Brexit rapidly approaching, and the referendum now more than 2 years ago, we still have very little idea what Brexit even is. The firmest thing we have still now is that Brexit means Brexit.
Yeah, that cliché's run and run, hasn't it?
Because we haven't got anything else since then.
Who'd have thought such a meaningless, pointless political statement would have survived pretty much the full 2 years since the referendum?
Well, you would have expected something else to have happened by now. But no, nothing else has really happened. Which leads into this story, because last week, the European Union Committee in the UK's House of Lords published a report warning that the live music industry does not have enough information on how Brexit will affect touring in Europe if and when we leave the European Union.
Yes, ever since that referendum on the UK's membership of the EU 2 years ago, plus there have been various panels at music industry events, of which I have moderated one and organised another, discussing the potential impact of Brexit and the UK leaving the EU on the music industry. And there are various elements to that. It may have an impact on our copyright laws. It may have an impact on pressing CDs and vinyl, because a lot of British labels rely on Eastern European pressing plants to get their stuff made. But I think that most people agree that the area where there could be the most turmoil as a result of Brexit when it comes to the music industry is on the touring side. And that's both UK artists who want to tour the rest of Europe, and of course artists based in the European Union who want to come and tour in the UK. And the problem with all the Brexit panels, and I've seen various conference programmes coming up in the autumn, and the Brexit panels, they seem to be increasing with frequency, which I suppose makes sense, given that Brexit Day, as it were, the day when in theory we're meant to walk away from the European Union, given that is now looming quite close by, it makes sense to have a lot more Brexit panels. Although pretty much every Brexit panel at every music industry conference, and I am assuming that every other kind of conference in the world, whatever industry, is presumably also having the generic Brexit panel. And my assumption is every single one of these panels, it's an hour of everybody saying, the thing is, we just don't know.
Yeah.
Because we don't know what's going to happen. But in some ways, the we just don't know is now the problem. We don't know what the problem will be after Brexit. And the fact that we don't know is the problem. And I suppose in some ways, that's what this report from the House of Lords was saying, remembering that plenty of venues and festivals and artists plan their concerts and their tours 18 months ahead.
Yeah.
So there are plenty of promoters who are already looking to late 2019, maybe even 2020, when it comes to touring Europe, when it comes to European artists coming here. And with the deadline next March and seemingly no real clarity on what that's going to mean, or even if there is going to be any deal by next March, and if there isn't, what happens? All of that confusion is already having a tangible negative impact on the live music industry.
Yeah, because what happens currently, if you're a UK artist who wants to go and play on the continent and you want to go to another EU country, then you just go there. That's fine. And then you come home again. Or you go to another one and it's fine. You can just travel around the EU freely because of the freedom of movement that members of the EU enjoy. But if we come out of the EU and there's no deal to keep that freedom of movement for touring artists, then we become outside the EU. And if you're an artist from outside the EU and you want to tour in the EU, it's a lot harder because you've got to get not only a visa for the first country you go to, but probably the next one and the next one. And all these countries have different rules for non-EU artists. And it can be very costly and time-consuming getting those visas.
Plus, of course, you need visas not only for the artists, but any session musicians, any crew,
yes,
any roadies, who you're, I mean, unless you're going to hire all of that locally in each country you go to.
Which the country might insist on or might not.
So lots of paperwork, lots of time and effort. And I suppose what everybody hopes is, well, I think what most of the music industry hopes is that this whole Brexit thing just goes away.
Yeah.
And everything carries on regardless. But let's assume that that's not a realistic expectation. I think what is hoped is that some sort of reciprocal can be agreed between the UK and the EU, specifically for creatives who are going into another EU country to perform. So that would not necessarily just be music, it would be anybody in the arts, and that some sort of deal could be done. And organisations like the Musicians Union and the ISM, the Incorporated Society of Musicians, have been calling for this quite vocally for quite some time. UK Music, which represents the wider music industry, has been calling for this for quite some time. But I think there are two issues, which is every single industry is making demands of government of the little get out, the side agreement that they want in the agreement, in whatever deal is done with the European Union. And however much the UK government likes to talk about our brilliant music industry and how they're proud of our music industry and how our music industry is going to be our calling card after Brexit. I mean, quite how far up the priority list, really.
There are other industries that are more important.
Our record companies and artists and touring stuff. And anyway, as it currently stands, even if we were pretty damn near the top of the priority list, there ain't a deal to be part of, because it's looking increasingly likely that we will get to next March with no deal having been agreed. Half of the Conservative Party, who are obviously in government here, are now sort of just seeing that as a, well, maybe that'll be a good thing. Let's not have a deal. Let's just walk away from the EU. And, I mean, if that does happen, I have to say, part of me kind of now hopes that does happen. I mean, it will be terrible, but it will be interesting. Because in theory, and I'm sure most people have seen this on social media or read it in various different articles, but, I mean, for example, in theory, if the UK crashes out of the EU next March without a deal, planes can't take off in the UK,
yeah,
in theory. Now, you have to assume that on the day we crash out, the planes will still take off, that some sort of fudge will be agreed on the day. But, I mean, that is just one of a big long list of things.
But the issue with that is that there's no regulator, because there's a European Union regulator for planes and air traffic control, all of that. And the UK doesn't have one. And it takes a really, really long time to train people up for that. So there's not time to sort that out before next March so that we can have a UK regulator. And then if we don't have that in place, then the insurers won't insure the planes to take off. And if the insurers won't insure the planes to take off, then the planes just won't take off. Because if you can't get insurance on a plane crashing, you kind of don't want to fly. It's quite expensive if they crash.
So, as I say, if that does happen, now, it's not really in the EU's interest for that to happen. So I assume that at the last minute, the EU will say, have another year to sort out all of this nonsense.
Yeah.
But if it did happen, it would be fascinating. I mean, would they just say, OK, well, we'll just keep the current system going for a few more weeks, blah, 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 or who knows? But that's the kind of messy situation that we're currently in the UK. But as I say, what this committee of the House of Lords are saying here is this is already having a negative impact because of the planning that goes into touring and festivals. And so the government should be making this a priority and making sure that we get these reciprocals in place. But although the music industry obviously welcomed this intervention from this committee in the House of Lords, there was also a separate report published last week by the aforementioned ISM, the Incorporated Society of Musicians, on this issue. Again, the music community will welcome that. But as I say, everything is such a mess at the moment, and there is such a long list of people who are saying, oh, but whatever happens, we must ensure this, we must ensure this. I mean, it will be terrible if British artists can't get into the EU, either because actually nobody knows what they need to do, so they can't, or even if we kind of work it out next February what they need to do, there'll be a 12-month gap because all the festivals and tours were already finalised, or once we know what the system is, it's too expensive for a lot of artists to go. And it'll be even, you know, I suppose from a music fan's perspective here in the UK, it will be even worse that European artists won't be able to get over here to play. So all of that will be terrible. Having said that, to be fair, if the government's going to sort out anything first, I mean, I think that airplane thing is quite high on the list. Of course, there's also getting food in, isn't there? And medicines and all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah, it's the fact that our ports can't cope with all the admin that's going to hit. So we're not going to have any food. Because most of our food comes from outside the UK.
Not any drugs.
No drugs.
So I suppose in we're the wider
I mean, yeah, so we're probably not going to be that concerned about going and seeing Armin van Buuren and Christine and the Queens playing some tunes because we will be hungry and dying. So.
And of course, all the British artists will be stranded. So we'll just have to make do with Ed Sheeran and
Ed Sheeran is sort of a perfect campfire artist, isn't he? He's just got his acoustic guitar. We'll have to get rid of his loop pedals, but he can just have his acoustic guitar and sit.
We'll have no power.
We're just all going to be sitting around campfires, hungry and dying, while Ed Sheeran annoys us with his songs. And we can go, oh, it just sounds like Marvin Gaye.
Yeah, but Marvin Gaye's lawyers, or rather the lawyers of the Marvin Gaye estate, won't be able to get into the country to do anything about it. So Ed will be free to nick, allegedly, whatever music he likes in the brave new world that will be Brexit Britain.
Well, I'm glad we found an upside to Brexit.
At last, we managed to locate it. But to conclude, once you've sorted out the planes and the food and the drugs, and the other 6,009 really important things that need to be sorted out so that life can carry on as normal. When you get to 6,010 on the list, will you please sort out some reciprocal visas between the EU and the UK so pop stars can continue to move around the continent playing their songs without having to fill out too much paperwork?
Just quickly, time for some news in brief now. The major labels have sued Cox Communications, a US ISP, which I believe we have discussed on this show before.
Yeah, because BMG sued them. BMG sued Cox Communications, accusing the ISP of only paying lip service to its policies to stop people amongst its customer base from infringing copyright and particularly repeat infringers. And when it went before a jury, BMG won and got loads of damages from Cox Communications. Although Cox Communications actually managed to get that overturned on appeal, but on a technicality, and the appeal judgment pretty much sided with BMG on the arguments in law, which is why Sony and Universal and Warner are now saying, we'll have a bit of that too, please. I mean, if Cox Communications are really slapdash when it comes to policing piracy on their networks, to the extent that they need to pay BMG a load of money, well, they need to pay us a load of money too. So yeah, the majors have now gone legal, officially suing Cox. It'll be interesting to see how the ISP responds.
UK consumers have given up pretty much on illegal downloading, which, I mean, is that, it's not that surprising, is it? Really?
We have talked about this before. I think we talked about it quite recently when I was having my moan about how hard it was to get through to the press office, intellectual property office.
I remember that.
Because the IPO put out a little bit of research about piracy levels in the UK. But last week it was YouGov putting out their latest piracy stats. They'd surveyed about 4,000 people. And of the 4,000 people, about 10% admitted to illegally downloading music, which was down from 18% when a similar survey was done 5 years ago. But as we have talked about before on Setlist, with the shift to streaming, it does sort of feel like old school file sharing of MP3s is sort of going to die out. Not least because you're getting to the point now where for a lot of consumers, just the idea of having actual files on your phone and on your laptop that you have to move around is sort of becoming something that people don't want to deal with. So what they want to do is stream. Now, whether or not they stream from legal services or illegal streaming services, well, that's a debate for another day. But yeah, I think old-fashioned illegal downloading is on the wane just because of shifts in music consumption. And certainly that's what the YouGov survey seemed to suggest.
You can find links to all these stories and everything else we've discussed this week in the show notes at setlistpodcast.com. And finally this week, the exact authorship of various Beatles songs remains up for debate, as it has been for decades now.
By which we mean, of the Beatles songs which were written by John Lennon and Paul McCartney, which is most of them.
Yeah.
Not all of them.
Not all of them.
But most of them. We know they were written by John Lennon and Paul McCartney. That isn't in dispute.
No.
It's not that the Marvin Gaye estate's having a go here as well. But the question is, when Lennon McCartney sat down to collaborate on songs, or actually sometimes didn't sit down to collaborate, they sort of were composing and writing in different rooms. When a song was written, it's like, okay, well, of that song, how much was McCartney's effort and how much was Lennon's effort? And from the way they are published and the way the copyrights were split, we don't know. Because they were always published as Lennon and McCartney as the writers. And as far as we understand it, in most, if not all cases, the copyright was just split 50-50. There was that Paul McCartney release where he swapped the order of the names around.
Yeah.
So it became McCartney-Lennon rather than Lennon-McCartney. But in all of the official copyright stuff and crediting, you don't know, other than that they were both involved, you don't know what their actual contributions were. But then I believe that once the Beatles had split up, there was a little bit of backwards and forwardsing between Lennon and McCartney where they were saying, oh, I mainly wrote that song. Oh, I mainly wrote that song.
Yeah, and in some cases, Lennon would say, oh, I mainly wrote that one, and McCartney would say, no, he didn't. So, but there's never been any... I mean, they probably can't remember. They wrote loads of songs.
Well, Lennon's dead, so...
And,
I mean,
well, that doesn't help either.
He definitely can't remember.
Anyway, we may now have an answer.
Science is coming to the rescue.
Yes.
Or maths, one or the other.
On at least one song. In My Life is one of various Beatles songs that's authorship has been disputed for many years because of Lennon McCartney saying contradicting things about who wrote what in that song. The dispute is basically like McCartney saying, I basically wrote that song, Lennon just wrote the lyrics, nothing else. But we don't know because, as you say, no one wrote down the exact splits and they're not going to remember. So these two researchers, Mark Glickman, the senior lecturer in statistics at Harvard University, and Jason Brown, professor of mathematics at Dalhousie University, have created a computer model which breaks Beatles songs down into 149 different components and then, they say, creates a musical fingerprint for each songwriter, which will then show you exactly who wrote how much of each song. And they've run it on In My Life to work that out because I don't know why you wouldn't go for one of the more famous disputed songs first, like Help. But that's what they've gone with. And they reckon that there is only a 1 in 50 chance that this is a song written by Paul McCartney. In fact, they're siding more with John Lennon, who reckoned that McCartney only wrote the middle eight and the harmonies. As disputes go, they're quite different accounts of how the song was written. And Mark Glickman, one of the researchers, said that Paul McCartney clearly misremembered what happened.
He lied.
He didn't go so far as to say he lied.
Maths has proven that McCartney is a barefaced liar, I think, is the conclusion of this. I think these two guys have got quite a lot of time on their hands. In the wider scheme of things, I'm not sure if it's the most important use of science and mathematics. Maybe like with the whole Brexit thing, it's sitting down there at number 6010 in the priority list. But still...
I don't see how it's exactly provable either, because you've gone like, oh, we've broken it down, we've worked out like who wrote what bit. Like, well, how? Exactly.
I mean, presumably you have to have some songs where there isn't a dispute in order to pull these bits out and fingerprint them and stuff like that. I don't know. Or maybe there's something really clever that we're not.
Or you'd have to have enough songs that I guess you could apply it to their solo catalogue and look for songwriting traits in,
interesting.
In those.
Interesting.
That's my. I mean, I haven't read the full study because, I mean, who's got time?
I certainly don't.
They have run it on another Beatles song, though. The Word, which is another song from Rubber Soul that was under dispute. And that one, although that was said to be more of a Lennon composition, their computer says that actually McCartney wrote it.
Oh, so there are winners and losers.
Yeah. So he's lost one, but he's gained another.
So the actual conclusion is they're both liars. Neither Lennon nor McCartney can be trusted.
I think that's the conclusion, yeah.
At the very least, when it comes to their versions of events with regards to their songwriting. If only they'd been writing their songs in the 21st century. You know that orderly system? They'd used the orderly system and then managed the backwards and forwards between them. Probably somewhere in the orderly data, it would probably say. In the future, we will know. Precisely. Yeah, the system says 36% was written by this person. 32% by that, or maybe more specific, that the melody is written by this person. Blah, blah, blah.
I mean, I think the only downside to that system is that it relies on people agreeing how much of a song they wrote there and then in the studio, which I think the disputes could quite easily start there.
Oh, no, but with the if you're using the orderly platform properly, it's a bit like a sort of messaging system between the writers. So there'll be lots of conversations going backwards and forwards and people sending their... Now, obviously, if they actually all go into the studio and collaborate together in one space, then only people who were in the room at the time. If there was an Echo device there, probably Alexa would know. But assuming that's not happening, then you're right. You're still relying on the songwriters themselves saying, yeah, I wrote this much, I did this.
And I
did
think
that.
What this research shows is you cannot rely on songwriters.
But if they were not in the same room and there was lots of backwards and forwards between here's my bit, here's your bit, then the system, if there was a messaging app, well, I don't even know why I'm having this conversation because there wasn't when they wrote these songs. And now there's this maths that says that Lennon and McCartney are liars, but in some ways, it so doesn't matter. I'm slightly at a loss as to why we've just spent 8 minutes talking about it. But hey, interesting. Interesting?
You can't say that and then claim it's interesting.
Was it interesting?
Oh, I don't know. Why don't you... well, there you go. That's how we're going to round up the podcast this week. Why don't you let us know if that was interesting? Because we don't know. You can tweet us. Satellist Pod, we're on Facebook, we're on Instagram, we're on LinkedIn.
What was more or less interesting, the heatwave conversation at the start or the Beatles stats at the end? Maybe there is some sort of mathematical machine that could solve that for us.
Yeah, I suppose you could email us that algorithm as an attachment, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk.
I'd like to put it on the record, whichever one you think was the more interesting, the heatwave conversation or the Beatles, I was behind that one, and he was behind the other.
Well, we'll see what the computer says. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It is presented by me, Andy Malt, and, well, it's some dispute, but also Chris Cook, apparently. It's produced by Matt Peaty. It's edited by Jason Wolfe. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.